Coming up on this week's episode of Check Your Balances, we've got listener questions on securities-based lending, accounting practices, and more. Stick around. That's coming up next.
Check Your Balances is a show produced and owned by Kraftwerk Capital. The views expressed by the hosts and their guests are personal opinions and should not be considered personal financial advice or the opinion of Kraftwerk Capital. All investments have risk and may lose money. Consult with your financial advisor, tax preparer, or attorney prior to implementing anything discussed, and please do not use this show as the sole basis for financial decisions.
Welcome back to another week of Check Your Balances. I am Ross Anderson, joined as always from his very comfortable prison cell, Dan Maseka. Good to see you, my friend.
Good to see you. I'm happy in this prison. And to peel back the curtain a little bit, every single week we record, the very first thing we talk about is, man, Dan, your background looks ridiculous. We need to do something about that. And we probably do. I did change up guitars behind me, so at least we have something different to look at today. But we'll snazz up my room a bit. Maybe we'll try some different angles and I'll look more exciting to all those people viewing on YouTube.
Well, it's funny because I think our longtime listeners and loyal listeners get it because we've joked about it before. But I realize people tuning in to the show for the first time don't know that you know it's ridiculous. And I think that that's the funny part, is that now that we're starting to get a little bit of traction on YouTube, that is something that those folks are not accustomed to yet. And they're just like, why is this guy talking to me from this blank wall?
And for those not watching, Ross has a very nice background. It's like backlit. It's got our company's color scheme and sound absorbing tiles, I suspect. And I have like nothing. I have a guitar hanging on the wall and white shades that aren't doing a good job of keeping the sun out of my room. That's about all you can see. But I'm happy. I'm happy in this room.
You're happy and comfortable. That's all we need, Dan. Well, this week, it is time for our December mailbag. It's where we open up the email inbox. We take a look at what our listeners are wanting to know more about. We've got three questions we are going to get through today, but we appreciate every time anyone writes in to us. Checkyourbalances@outlook.com is the email address for the show. We love hearing from you. We love hearing what you're looking at in the finance world, where your questions are. And so thank you for those of you that have been writing in and listening for quite a while. We are going to start with a question from Summer. Summer writes in, says, hello, gentlemen. I've gotten three different emails from banks I currently have a relationship with offering me an SBL, which is a securities-based line of credit. I'm curious on the timing of all three. Did something change in the laws to make this now available? It looks like a short-term loan, but I can't figure out any details based upon the fine print that's offered by it in the link. I have to contact the banks. I don't need a loan. I'm just curious what the terms would be, what the pitfalls would be out there beyond the obvious. Didn't see it in our podcast topics. Did you miss it? Nope, you didn't. I don't think we've covered this. So any comments on the securities-based line of credit?
Yeah, so I think it's important to start with the fact that there are two ways you can borrow against securities. There's the securities-based line of credit, and there's a securities-based loan. They're different, similar concept. Essentially, what the bank is doing is saying, look, you have this money here. It could be in stocks. It could be in a CD. Something tied away. And they're telling you, if you want access to money, but don't want to touch these things, we can lend to you against the money that you already have here to make it liquid and make you not have to do anything with those holdings in order to access the cash.
Right. So they're just using your portfolio as the collateral for the loan. So just like you would get a home equity line of credit, this is kind of what that is. But the thing that they're going to take away from you in this case, if you default on the loan and you don't give them their money back, is going to be your securities portfolio. So this is very similar to what a margin loan would look like in terms of its function. And a lot of times when we see these, it's the broker or the institution that already holds your account will do this. I saw it a lot when I was at Morgan Stanley. Schwab has these, Interactive Brokers has these, right? So all of the major brokers will tend to do this at varying rates of interest. And normally it's their in-house bank that is actually underwriting it. So for Schwab, I believe it's Schwab Bank that is kind of issuing the loan. So they're using their own capital to give you the cash, right? So there's always a banking element involved, but it doesn't have to be the bank that you're actually working with as the broker that issues a loan. So third-party banks can do this. They can lend against a securities portfolio. And so that's what you're seeing the offers for. I find it curious that you'd get three kind of back to back from different banks. I don't know if maybe those are related banks or maybe this time of year, rather than people going in and selling things for gains because everybody's kind of concerned about taxes. I wonder if they just think this is a good time to send those offers out because people are trying to raise cash but not sell securities. So that could be all it is that's going on here.
Right, because this isn't new. This isn't a new product or a new opportunity. This has been around forever. But I think you touched on it. It's probably end of year. People are thinking about taxes. It's been a relatively good market year, depending on where you've kept your money. So maybe they're thinking people are sitting on gains and don't want to sell and might want access to their money. On top of that, interest rates are up. So it's an opportunity for the financial institutions to potentially collect more in revenue from the people they're lending to. It could be as simple as that.
Yeah, I mean, in my mind, it's actually not a bad way if you needed to borrow some money, especially on a short-term basis. You know, the risks of this are just like margin. So you could see issues on either side. If for some reason you lend at a very high rate against the capital and the value of the capital drops, you could basically get margin called or forced out of these securities. So that's the really big risk in these. The other one is partially why some of the brokers really like doing them. Let's say you take some money out against that line of credit and you've got a large account at Morgan Stanley. You cannot move that account from Morgan Stanley until you satisfy that loan. And so from their perspective, this is a great tool. Why? Well, number one, they get to continue earning their fees on all of the money you have because you haven't taken a withdrawal. Number two, they also get to earn interest on the money you've borrowed against that very same collateral. And then number three, you can't move your account until you settle up. And so if you've taken a fairly large draw against it, it makes you an incredibly sticky customer. Likewise, the banks that are offering this against somebody else's money are basically saying, hey, you've already got that there. Why don't I earn some interest? Because I'm not making anything on this. You know, so if they know that you've got assets for some reason, that's a common thing that they would want to do is, hey, cool, we can lend against this. It's very low risk for us because all we have to do is calculate the value of your collateral. And it's publicly traded. They can mark that to market every single day and know exactly what the value of your collateral is. Unlike your home, where there's a very rigorous process to go sell it if they had to take your home from you, or even just the fact that they don't know what condition it's in. Your collateral in a securities-based line of credit, it's incredibly liquid. It's easy to know, easy to understand. And so from a risk management standpoint, I think banks like this business quite a bit.
Yeah. So again, I think the areas where this might be worthwhile are if you need quick access to cash for something short-term and you don't want to sell a security because you've had it for a long time and maybe there are a lot of embedded gains and you don't want to pay the taxes. A line of credit could be a good way to get the cash temporarily. Return it when you have the liquidity, no harm, no foul. Or a loan, unlike a line of credit, is an upfront amount that you're going to pay over time at a fixed rate. If you don't have other assets to borrow against, that might be preferable versus like an unsecured loan from a bank where you might be paying a higher rate. So if you have the money tied up in securities that you don't want to pay taxes on, maybe you can get more favorable terms than going to ABC Bank and saying, hey, it's me. Will you lend me money? And them saying, sure, but we're going to charge you a lot for it.
Yeah, the pricing on these is pretty widely variable. So if you are thinking about doing this, if it's something that applies to your situation, shop around a little bit. Your broker may not be the best option. And so that's a common thing that we would see. Some of the brokers price this stuff really aggressively, and some of them are pretty egregious in terms of, you know, where they're going to price that banknote. And that's up to them, right? Banks are for-profit entities. They don't have to be cheap. But I would definitely shop this around a little bit if it's something that you are considering. I know we're spending a decent amount of time on this. I think the one other thing that's kind of interesting is you see this used in high finance too. And so the one that comes to mind is some of the financing that Elon Musk did when he bought Twitter was basically borrowing against the value of his Tesla shares to create enough cash without having to sell Tesla, recognize all these capital gains. So I do believe he financed quite a bit of that deal with some pretty high finance banks to come up with the, you know, $44 billion or whatever it was that he paid for Twitter. Supposedly not currently worth that, but you know, what do I know? So yeah, that this gets used, like when you hear about, hey, how did they reach all that capital? That's kind of what this is using the securities as collateral. So it's just the consumer version of that that you're seeing from the bank.
Yeah, that's a great example and relevant. Good job, Ross.
You know what? It's almost like we're putting together a podcast here and hoping that it's entertaining. All right, let's move on to our next question. And we are going to get into some accounting. This comes to us from Andrew. It says, hope you both have a happy Thanksgiving. We did. Thank you for that. He is writing in for the first time. And the question is around non-controlling interests. Oh, go ahead.
Before we get into it.
Sure.
Andrew, I love you. My favorite part of this whole email is where he says he's enjoyed most of the conversations we've had, where my mind goes immediately to, well, which parts haven't you enjoyed? I'm guessing it's the golf. We don't have people who enjoy golf.
We hear a lot about that. We also hear a lot about peanut butter and jelly in the affirmative. I do think people like our peanut butter and jelly related content.
We should start an offshoot of just peanut butter and jelly content.
Every week we argue about how many utensils to use.
All right, let's proceed with accounting.
Well, yeah, he actually does. He says really enjoy most of the conversation since you're going to pick it out. Says can't say I follow some of the tax talk. So Andrew is one of those that sometimes when we go down a tax rabbit hole, maybe doesn't love everything we do there. But we do get a lot of good comments about some of the tax work, too. So we try and mix it up. We hope you get something for all of your financial interests here. OK, back to his email. He says, for context, I've been investing in individual companies for about 5 years. Consider myself firmly in the long-term buy and hold camp, which we applaud you for. Each year, I've gotten more detailed with my analysis of the companies that I follow, and that's led me to a point where I put a lot of weight on the balance sheet while developing my thesis for or against an investment. I've seen a couple times now this non-controlling interest line in the stockholders' equity section, and I was hoping you could provide some insight on how to think about it. Is it bad? Is it good? How does it impact the total value of a company if some of the equity and earnings are attributed to non-controlling interests? Dan, put your accounting hat on. What are we talking about here?
That's a great question, and I can see why it would be confusing. The answer in general is pretty simple. It's more complicated how it impacts the financial statements. But when a company buys a controlling interest in another company, there is a threshold at which they can wrap up the financials of that second company into their own financials. So let's say I buy Daniel Incorporated buys 80% of Ross Incorporated. That's what we've done. I've acquired a majority stake in your business, Ross. Now, when Ross reports revenue, I can count that under my own financial statement. I'm going to report Ross's revenue as part of my revenue. However, I didn't buy all of Ross's company. I bought 80% of it. So 20% of what I'm reporting is attributable to non-controlling interest. So when you see that on the balance sheet, that is reflective of the portion of Ross's company that I do not own. So that's important to note. Similarly, a portion of Ross's revenue, which I'm reporting under my own balance sheet or under my own financial statements, are not mine. It's Ross's. He owns 20% of that. But that math is done for you, thankfully. So if you're looking at the financial statements and the income statement, there is a section that actually backs that number out for you. So it subtracts out the revenue associated with the non-controlling interest or the minority interest. Or, funnily enough, if they lost money, it'll add that back to my financials. So it's not a good or bad thing. It's just a thing that's being reported. I think I've lost myself even as I was saying that.
Well, yeah, it's funny that the example we were talking about this pre-show right before we started rolling, and you gave a very clean, simple example. And I think when you made it about buying me and my company, it made it way more complicated.
Yeah.
So if our business, Craftwork Capital, if we go out and buy 80% of a car wash, and
which we've talked about, by the way.
We have talked about buying a car wash. I am interested in owning a car wash. If you buy a car wash, and let's say that car wash is doing $100,000 in revenue, but we only bought 80% of it, to use Dan's example. So we control the car wash. It's ours. We can do what we want with it. We have enough votes to tell them to do whatever we want to do. They make $100,000. We have to show the whole $100,000 on our income statement. We have to consolidate our income statement with theirs. And so our interest in that car wash says we've got to show $100,000, but then we're going to back out the $20,000 for the part of it we don't own. So on the income statement, you're going to see overstated income, and then you're going to see a reduction for that part that you don't own. The same thing is happening on the balance sheet. So in the example you gave me, and you gave me an individual stock to look at, but if you go look at the income statement, you're going to see the same thing, that not only do they own the subsidiary, so they have to back out the equity value that they don't own, they also have to back out the income value that is not attributable to them. And in the case that you sent me, it was negative, so it actually looks like an add back item. So in this case, the company was showing like that they had lost, I want to say it was like $85 million, but $60 million was lost by people that owned other stuff. So then the net of what they lost was 25. Anyway, so I'll let you go down that rabbit hole. I didn't want to actually pick apart the individual financials, but that's what's going on there, is they have to show that in the consolidated format, but that's not really their revenue. It's not really their equity. So they're backing it out. You think we lost everybody, Dan? Did our listenership drop to zero in our accounting explanation?
We'll find out next week.
Actually, I don't know that we'll find out. We can tell how many times the podcast has been downloaded, but we can't tell how long people listen. So,
long enough to know about our utensil preference for peanut butter and jelly sandwiches.
It's true. I don't know where we normally cover that, but it's probably normally at the end. All right, let's get into one more, Dan, unless you had something else on non-controlling interest to add.
No, I just wanted to make sure we covered it and put a bow on it. So again, it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just documenting basically what's happened in the past with acquisition of businesses. So it's whatever portion that you don't own of a company that you have essentially a majority stake in, and they're backing out the part that isn't yours. So you don't need to do wizardry. It's all there for you. But when you see non-controlling interest or minority interest, I've seen it that way too, that's what it's referring to.
All right. So our last email for today comes to us from Jack. And he was writing into us about the cockroach portfolio. Enjoyed your episode on that. Sounds like it's the same as the permanent portfolio, which was designed by Harry Brown in the 70s. There's a more modern version called the Golden Butterfly, which is 20% each to the U.S. stock market, small cap value, gold, long-term treasuries, and cash. This portfolio is especially good for those that are saving for a medium-term goal or during retirement, and that it has a very high safe withdrawal rate. I don't think people betting on gold or putting gold in these portfolios are expecting the apocalypse. I think gold is the asset that tends to perform well during a crisis, and through rebalancing, you can use the gold in your portfolio to buy the other assets which have fallen during that crisis. It says his personal portfolio is a modification of that he calls the 30-20, 30% in the total U.S. stock market, 30% in small cap value, 20 in treasuries, 20 in gold. So he's eliminated the cash. That's interesting. It has a safe withdrawal rate approaching 6%, which is good because I have achieved financial independence and I'm within a few years of retiring. As they say, once you've won the game, you stop playing. His final thing here is he puts a plug for portfoliocharts.com, which I have not checked out yet, but I will take a look. Really interesting. So I find two things in there that I think we can comment on. Number one is the safe withdrawal rate being kind of pegged at 6%. Keep in mind, anytime somebody's doing that, that is a back testing, right? Is in the past what safe withdrawal rate has worked, but the safe withdrawal rate also depends on what you're doing with it. Are you rebalancing it according to how the back test was done, et cetera? And I think sometimes that back testing is done not incorrectly, I believe the academics of it, but you got to remember how you would respond in the exact same situation. It means that you've responded like the robot in the back test to say, yes, 6% is the withdrawal rate. I don't know that I would be comfortable using a 6% withdrawal rate, even if it works most of the time or it was back tested to work. I think I would still probably handicap that a little bit to account for the uncertainty of what's going on in the future. The second thing that I think we can comment on, Dan, is really any uncorrelated asset, being able to diversify out of it or into it, That is the point of having a diversified portfolio. That's why we would want things that don't all move in the same direction at the same time. So stocks and bonds tend to be non-correlated. Cash tends to be not correlated to most of those. So gold being in that mix, I absolutely agree that is its point. But ultimately, we want it to be a long-term positive return in addition to being a diversifier. And so I think, you know, that is completely fine to have gold in a portfolio if that's your view on it. Dan, I guess as you read through his modification, did anything stick out to you?
You know, I think when we talked about the cockroach portfolio, the one thing we said was, would we do this? And we came to the conclusion that it's not crazy, right? It's not a harmful thing. And I think what he's illustrating here is also not a harmful thing. I think if it's a strategy that you're willing to keep up with for the long term, it is a positive rather than a negative to doing nothing or doing something what I would consider dangerous. I also am a little bit concerned about a 6% safe withdrawal rate, even if it's back tested successfully, because sequence is really important. So if you have a couple down years, you know, 6% of something that's dropped is now it's really hard to go forward unless you're adjusting your 6% for whatever your current balance is, because otherwise that's what, 17 years of runway in retirement, assuming no growth.
Yeah, I mean, the modification that he gives, 30% U.S. stock market, 30% small cap value. So we're 60% equities, and none of that is international. So we are, you know, diversified between small caps and the U.S. stock market, if you look at the whole thing, is going to be heavily weighted towards large caps. But so he's saying a big overweight in small cap value, and then 20% in treasuries, 20% in gold. And specifically, he notes long-term U.S. treasuries. Long-term U.S. treasuries are a pretty volatile asset class. We know that because they took out a couple banks earlier this year.
They're dead.
So you can be, to me, to have removed cash from that modification, I think if you're looking at the last 10 years and saying, yeah, cash is an underperforming asset, it is a low performing asset, you know, we've kind of had this cash is trash mentality, or there is no other, you know, option, the TINO acronym. There's been like a bunch of stuff talked about in this. I don't know that I would remove the cash from the portfolio, because similar to the way he's talking about gold, that it is it's what you reach for in a crisis. To me, that safety blanket is cash. That is money that I can go out and spend with zero notice, with zero volatility. Yes, there's an erosion of purchasing power over time, but there is nothing that makes me feel as secure as having cash. But I am completely respectful of people that have different views. I would just look at that portfolio modification and say, well, where's the liquidity? You know, what are you assuming that you've either got access to the treasuries or to the gold at any given time, or that you're going to pull from the stocks? I mean, that's really what it's, you're betting on one of the three of those being a good option at any given time, which could be true. And obviously the back test works well, and that's why they're saying there's a 6% withdrawal rate back test. But I would be nervous about that.
Yeah. Offhand, I don't remember what gold did last year in 2022, but I know long-term bonds didn't do well. I know small caps and the total stock market didn't do well. So, you know, again, like you said, if gold is going to be your liquidity and you're seeing it that way, you know, that's something that you can go for. But hopefully there's cash somewhere else if we're banking on living off of that portfolio.
Yeah, no, I honestly, I think it did work last year, because I looked at this recently because I was talking about the quilt chart, which is really just the how did different asset classes return. This doesn't show gold specifically, but commodity returns 2022, 16.1. So that was really the best performing asset class in 2022. So that would support this. So second best, by the way, was cash at 1.5. But then you had high yield and fixed income at, you know, double digit negative numbers, large cap stocks, double digit negative numbers, small cap stocks, double digit negative numbers. So that absolutely supports the theory that if, you know, commodities are the asset that are going to float in that time. So 2022 actually, I think, is a reinforcing year for that. But there have been very few years looking at this that cash has been a high performing one. So I get it. I think I get why you would make that modification. It would make me nervous, right? So that is ultimately what we're trying to say here. We're not saying one is right or wrong, but for me, I would want some cash just because of how easily accessible it is. And I just don't trust that I could get money out of one of those other instruments right when I want to.
Right. Yep.
Well, that's it for our three questions today. I hope that that was helpful. We got into securities lending, we got into accounting topics, and we talked about the modifications to the butterfly portfolio or to the cockroach portfolio. Hopefully that was good stuff and you enjoyed it. But if you want to hear us talk about different things, again, check your balances at outlook.com is the email address for the show. Dan, anything to close with, buddy?
If this is the last episode you're listening to before your holidays, we wish you happy holidays, happy year end. We'll do a year end wrap up, I believe, before our year closes. No, I have nothing to add.
All right. Fair enough. Well, thanks for tuning in, everybody. We will catch you next week on another episode.